who had been at least temporarily struck down by the New South Wales Attorney General, Frank Walker, because of this inquiry, this report into the family financial family affairs of Ian Sinclair. I mean, he was quite shattered by it all. When I say shattered, he was shattered that he had to stand down. He knew that there was no option because of the allegations there. He wasn't shattered in the context that, my God, how could this happen? He was, on the contrary, very confident of the fact that they can raise these allegations against me, but there's no way in the world they can make them stick. And he was subsequently cleared of all allegations. But, I mean, it rocked Doug Anthony. It rocked the party as a whole. And that's why when Ian stood down and Nixon was put in as the deputy leader, he was only ever appointed as the acting deputy leader, because it was always assumed that once Ian was cleared, he'd come back as the deputy leader. There was never any dispute about that. One thing about the party in those days, particularly the hierarchy of it, because you had Doug Anthony, Ian Sinclair, Peter Nixon, Ralph Hunt, in particular as the four primary leaders, cabinet ministers, but leaders of the party, they were all four of them great mates. The party respected all four of them. The party absolutely stuck together like glue, you know, and so there was never any, quite often you find when a politician falls foul in one sort of sense or another, some of his colleagues start to say, oh gee, you know, that this guy's led weight in the saddlebags, we'd better get rid of him or dump him down or put him on the back bench or something like that. That was never in question with Sinclair, which is why he came back into the cabinet too as soon as he was cleared. But now, in terms of the wider party, because the New South Wales party organisation, I mean, everybody rallied behind Sinclair's, particularly the New South Wales party, which was his home base party.
Mm-hmm. Were you expecting the change of government in 83?
Yeah, I was expecting it in 1980. yeah. They were not travelling too well in 1980, and there's a funny little story there. Peter Walsh, who was a West Australian senator, was the shadow minister for primary industry in 1980, and the campaign got underway, and countrywide, as it was then called, I think it's now called Landline, but the ABC's television rural program arranged to do a live debate, excuse me, between Peter Nixon and Peter Walsh, and it was to be done out of the studio here in Canberra, and Nixon and I were driving from Parliament House up to the ABC studios on Northbourne Avenue. He was not in a very good mood, Nixon, you know, sort of saying, you know, what have we got on this bloke, you know, how are we going to nail him and this and that, and I just said, look, I don't know, but I, you know, he had a whole heap of briefing papers on policy, and I was saying, you know, they haven't got a policy on this and this and this, and Nixon was saying, yeah, I know that, but, you know, that's no good. I mean, what have we got on this guy? And we were just pulling into the car park, and I just said to him, well, Minister, don't forget that Peter Walsh is well and truly on the public record on several occasions as supporting reintroduced death duties or wealth taxes. And again, he turned around and his eyes were twinkling. He said, right. And in we go, and this program gets going. And, well, you know, it was trailing on in its usual fairly monotonous sort of way. And it was actually the interviewer who turned round to Peter Walsh and said, well, you know, Peter, the Labor Party and you yourself have been advocates in the past of wealth taxes or death duties. You know, where does the party stand now? And Walsh tried to, you know, said, oh, well, you know, we'll have an inquiry into wealth taxes. And Nixon just said, oh, you're trying to wiggle too much, Peter. And Walsh said, I'm not trying to wiggle. Nixon interjected again and said, so, well, what will it be? Will it be wealth taxes or death duties? And he said, we will either have wealth taxes or death duties, words to that effect. But he made the commitment, as opposed to there being a review, he made the commitment. Well, we got back in the car, I raced out a press release, and Nixon rang me the next morning. We got together the next morning and didn't get a run anywhere. Not a bloody word, you know. Nixon was furious. Rewrite the thing, get it out again. So I did, by which time we were up in Cairns, because we were flying up to Cairns to campaign up there, still hadn't got a run. So Nixon then gets on to Tony Eggleton, the Liberal Party's federal director, told him what we'd got and, you know, sent him a fax of the transcript and said, look, you know, we can't get it up. You're going to have to put money in it. Put some money into it. Run a TV ad. And Eggleton, yes, Peter, well, I'll see what we can do, this and that. Nothing happened. And then, anyway, the beginning of the last week of the campaign, sort of from the Sunday through to the TV advertising blackout, midnight on the Wednesday, the Libs came up with this TV commercial, which was a real El Cheapo thing. It was just aerial shots of roofs, probably in Western Sydney, you know, warning that, you know, under Labor you'll get a wealth tax or death duty, or Labor will reintroduce death duties, words to that effect. It was a negative scarer. And we got back in, and many people credited the fact that that was the issue that put the nail into the lid of Labor at that time. But coming back to your point, 83, I had very little doubt that we were going to lose in 83. It was, you could smell it in the air.
A question arises from what you previously said. How is it that what you would think would be a real news story of importance doesn't get picked up?
Yes, particularly a story like that. But a lot of the key gallery journos, of course, at the time were travelling, either with the Prime Minister or the Leader of the Opposition on their campaign trail. So what you've got left behind in Canberra are more junior reporters. Now, I'm not saying that that's the reason that it just didn't get picked up, but it could be a contributing factor. The other point is that it's off the mainstream, if you like, and it's not coming from the leader. I'll bet you had it. I mean, had this been something that had happened between Fraser and Hayden, it would have been picked up and run because they were leaders. The focus on the primary party leaders, first and foremost, the Prime Minister, the Leader of the Opposition, whether it's Labor, Liberal, Labor, doesn't matter, but that there is the key focus. Much less of a focus on the Leader of the Country Party, or the National Country Party as it then was, and even less focus again on any ministers who are not one of those top three. So, you know, I mean, a contributing factor, I suppose, but it certainly annoyed Nixon. It annoyed me. I thought it was a good story, that it was worth doing. I tried to hammer around, rang people in the gallery, rang people this and that and everything else, and just didn't bite. Yeah, of course, they might have thought there was nothing really new in it, because it was a known fact that Peter Walsh favoured these taxes, but they just didn't read closely enough the fact that he had actually got to the point of making a commitment.
By the way, did you eventually join the party?
Yeah, but not for quite a long time. After the 83 election, Doug Anthony asked me to stay on and be a sort of special advisor to the parliamentary party in opposition, which I did for 83. And at the end of 83, he asked me if I'd go down and take over the federal secretariat as the federal director, and I did that. And I didn't join the party. I joined the party when I actually, I'm jumping forward a bit here, I didn't actually join the party until I became the New South Wales Party's General Secretary, which was, 1997 or thereabouts? Mm-hmm. And the reason I joined, the reason I hadn't joined, I had no philosophical reason for not joining. I just felt that in myself, I just felt that by not being a member, I could argue a greater degree of independent professionality, objectivity. It's a lot easier when you go into a party room, for instance, as a federal director, into your own party room, and say to the guys, look, you're intending to go down this path on a particular policy line, but you need to be aware that your federal council has got a totally opposite line. You are contravening the policy of the party. Not that that is something you cannot do in the National Party. The Parliamentary Party is not bound by the policy of the organisation. But it's a lot easier to be able to say to them, you're heading down a dangerous path here and going against the party line if you are not a member of the party line, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
The reason I joined was because to be General Secretary in New South Wales under the party's constitution, the General Secretary was the returning officer at all elections of internal elections of party office bearers, and the returning officer was constitutionally required to be a member, financial member of the party.
Now, we're now at 1983 when you become federal director, as you mentioned. How are you feeling? Do you want a break at this stage?
No, I'm fine.
Should we keep going?
Yeah,
okay.
Fine. Yeah.
Good. All right. Well, how do you think you were qualified for that position?
I probably, in many respects, wasn't qualified for it. I mean, Doug Anthony asked me to go down there, and so I did. I had a pretty good grounding now as to how the party worked, both at federal and state levels, and I understood that each state national party is an autonomous organisation, operates under its own constitution. The federal organisation basically is simply it's an affiliation of those affiliated state parties. Federal organisation basically doesn't have power. It has no constitutional power to intervene in the affairs of the state parties. So I knew this. I also knew what the parliamentary party saw as the failings of the federal secretariat, because at the time I'd been in parliament. The history of the secretariat, in a way, was the fact that McEwen wanted to establish a federal secretariat because he knew the time would come when the party would be in opposition. And when it was in opposition, he didn't want the country party to be beholden to the advice and the policy directions that were coming out of the Liberal Party secretariat for the Liberal Party. And he knew very well that if the country party didn't have its own capacity, we would have to turn around cap in hand to the Libs and say, look, can we take your material that's come out of your resources and use them? So he wanted that degree of independence. Now, the parliamentary party by the 1980s was pretty dissatisfied with the federal secretariat because they didn't feel it was doing really anything at all, particularly to help them. It's less important when you're in government because, in government you've got the resources of the departments to draw on and things like that. But moving into a period of opposition where you haven't got that, where you need to be seen to have a certain degree of independence, or at least of thinking, from the Liberal Party, even though you might be in coalition in opposition, you've got to have an ability to be a little bit independent. And there was a view that that wasn't happening. There was also a view in the state parties that the federal secretariat was a complete waste of time and money, because the state secretariats could do what the federal secretariat was supposed to do in any event. So I went in there basically with a view to try to make sure that we provided the federal pollies with the sort of material that was useful to them in terms of briefing materials, so that they could get back to their electorates. And also with a view to getting a far better working relationship between the state and the federal secretariats and head offices. And over time, I think we did it quite well. We had, for instance, there was a TV camera down in the secretariat, quite a good quality one, a big, big, huge JVC thing. And when the federal budget, Labor would bring down its federal budget, for instance, we'd take it up to the party room in Parliament House, and we would video all our backbenchers, if they wanted to do it, any backbencher. We'd do a video interview. I'd do the interview with the guy on his reaction to the budget, and we'd overnight courier it up to their local TV stations. And it might have been, for instance, Ray Braithwaite up in Mackay. We'd fire a piece up there, and it'd be on the air the next night. And this was a brilliant sort of service. It was really like a televised press release, if you like. But because we'd done the interview, and I quite deliberately put aggressive questions to them, I told them I would, you know, and they were all happy to go along with that. That worked very well. And then we developed a system of what I call dot-dotters. You just do draft press release, you know, the member for dot-dot-dot, Mr. dot-dot-dot, said today, on any good issue, any issue that I thought was worthwhile for the backbench members or even the frontbench members, and I'd fire those out to them. Then we put out a weekly political bulletin which contained all sorts of briefing materials, background notes and things like that, that got mailed out. And come elections, we had what was called the Federal Leaders Campaign that was funded by the federal organisation, and that was basically his television campaign, which was nationwide television advertising, which basically sat on top of the TV ad campaigns that the state parties had put together, which might sound a bit complex, but there was a lot of sense in that in a way, because you'd get your federal leader sort of taking the top high ground in a manner that highlighted the priority issues of the party in a broad sense that would quite happily be acceptable right across the country. And then if you wanted to get into a particular issue, say it was assets test or something like that, you might want to run a campaign in Queensland a lot differently to the way you would in New South Wales, mm-hmm. or for that matter in Victoria. That's why each state party was left to develop its own television advertising for what we called issues-based ads and candidate ads. So the federal campaign was that television campaign for the leader, and also paying for and organising the federal leader's launch, the venue of it, and all the bits and pieces that went in behind that. And then beyond that, through the state organisations sending out election bulletins, which were sort of a weekly bulletin, but by fax, by mail, by whatever means we could, to all the candidates, all National Party candidates Australia-wide, and also to the head offices, so that they knew what was coming out of Canberra. And it cut down unnecessary duplication. They understood what I was doing. I didn't intervene in what they were doing, and it actually all sort of worked out quite well. So those are the key things that I did, really, I suppose.
The first one you mentioned of televising or filming responses from backbenchers and sending them into state to different TV people, was that new? Were other parties already doing that?
No, other parties were doing it, and it lasted a few years, but the regional television stations got together. And quite justifiably, I think there was enough of them. They got together and they said, look, you know, there's obviously potentially enough news that can come out of Canberra, which is a value to broadcast in regional areas. So why don't we pull some money in and set up our own regional TV news office in the press gallery, which they did. Once that happened, they basically banned the use of of anything that came out of a party political organisation or anything that wasn't recorded through their journo on the ground here. So that sort of killed it in the end. But it was very innovative. It hadn't been done before, and I don't think it's been done since.
I think that maybe something similar has been done with the internet, you know, grabs that they provide.
Well, nowadays I'm sure that's probably right. But it's probably done by individuals too, as much as anything else. Yeah, you're right, technology has moved on rapidly and vastly since those days. We did the same with radio too. We'd send a little radio audios out to radio stations and things like that. That wasn't as necessary because the poly could ring up the radio station and do it himself. So, you know, there wasn't as much done on radio. But getting the pictorial, the picture and the movement, the pictures onto TV was the important one.
And in 1983, what was the staffing of the
Federal Secretariat? There was myself, was Jan Hurst, she was a researcher, Cecile Ferguson was a researcher, and Chrissy Incher was the receptionist, four of us. Mm-hmm. And come elections, we all mucked in and, you know, did it all. We all sort of mucked in and helped each other and did various things. It was very small. Later on, we got another lady, Sonny Willis, she joined, so we went up to five. And even today, it's only about the same. Yeah, it's only about the same. Well, we had Susie Mitchell, sorry, so that's there were five of us, and then, yeah, Chrissy stayed on, so we must have... Oh, no, Jan Hurst left. That's when Sonny Willis came in. So we were always five. Okay. Five. Mm-hmm. Well, today it's about the same.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk now about the rebranding of the party name, yeah, you know, from Country Party to National Country and then to National? What are your views on that?
I always think it's such a shame that it dropped the word country in its name. I mean, country is a lovely word. It's warm. It's friendly. It gives you a nice feeling, you know. And I've had many arguments with Doug Anthony about this. Not nasty arguments, but discussions with him, because he and I are very good friends. But I mean, it was his initiative to change the name from Country Party to National Country Party. Back he began it basically after the 72 election. He started analysing the election results, the demographics, and came to the conclusion that basically the party would not have a future if it just continued to market itself as a country party. He felt that that was just too sectional. And he was probably right. I'd have to concede he was probably right. He was helped a lot by the Queensland Party, which coincidentally, at the same time, was also moving to change its name. It was called the Country Party in Queensland. And they, in about 1983 or thereabouts, changed to National Party. For very much the same reason, more aggressively though, they wanted to break into Brisbane, into out of Brisbane seats. So they changed to National Party. That did help Doug in terms of his campaign. He had a very strong campaign to wage in New South Wales, which was very strongly opposed to any change of name. But he managed to get the parties around. Victoria was was also not all that in favour. South Australia and Western Australia were also probably more Country Party in favour of Country Party, but New South Wales was the key, I think. And Doug managed to get a motion through. Well, there was a motion. Yeah, he no doubt engineered it a bit, that got through one of the New South Wales state conferences, which called on the federal organisation to commission an independent assessment and analysis, etc., etc., which came down in favour of changing the party's name, and went into all sorts of reasons as to why, etc., etc. And so it came to pass. Not without a lot of internal debate and heart rending and everything else. New South Wales, when they, because each state party, as I said, was autonomous, so each state party had to change its name itself too, if it was going to. I mean, federally they changed in May 1975, and Doug did have a compromise. As I say, Queensland had gone from Country Party to National Party. Doug thought that because it was a federal party and there was a need to sort of maintain a link with the state parties, he sort of took the middle line and called the federal party National Country Party. That way, National Party worked with the Queenslanders, Country Party worked with the parties that were still Country Party. And gradually they changed. Victoria went straight from Country Party to National Party. Then South Australia and Western Australia went to National Country Party. New South Wales, I think, was the last to come aboard in about 1987 or thereabouts. And they had a very acrimonious debate on changing the name at their annual conference in Wagga. Very acrimonious. There was a lot of heartache there. One state guy, Bruce, his name will come to me. But the moment the vote was taken, he left the conference, resigned from the party and sat in the state parliament as an independent in protests. Those sort of things happened. Mm. Ralph Hunt, who only died recently, but good old Ralph, who was another lovely friend of mine, he used to say changing the party name was outrageous. But as I say, I think Anthony got the call right, because the party, clearly its pure rural base was declining. The number of traditional rural electorates was declining because of demographic, economic changes and everything else. And if the party was to survive, it definitely had to appeal to a broader demographic. The name change was part and parcel of that.
Mm-hmm. This is a good time to ask about Doug Anthony. Now, he retired from Parliament in, 84?
Beginning of 84.
And, you've written about the Anthony family and you knew Doug Anthony, as you've said. This is an opportunity, if you would like, to put on record how you see his particular contribution to the party and to the Parliament. And if you can give us an indication of how you experienced him as a individual, a character,
Anthony was again one who was taught by McEwen, and I think that is so important. John McEwen was a succession planner extraordinaire. I mean, it was an obsession with him. And he was very fortunate in having those four guys, not for as long, Ralph Hunt, because Ralph didn't go in until 69 and McEwen retired in 71. But Nixon, Sinclair and Anthony, McEwen really, really trained those guys up so that any one of them could have taken on the leadership when he retired. As the cookie crumbled, it was Doug that took the job on, and Doug that became McEwen's deputy too before that. Doug Anthony was a couple of the guys in the gallery used to regard him as a bit of a hayseed, just a country bumpkin, a pig farmer from Woolloombar. He was a pig and dairy farmer. He was a very astute one, and it was very easy to sort of write off somebody as just being a bloody pig farmer. Gough Whitlam definitely underestimated Doug Anthony, absolutely underestimated him in terms of Anthony's political acumen, no doubt assisted particularly by Sinclair, whose knowledge of the workings of Parliament and constitutional affairs was extremely strong. But Doug trumped Whitlam time and again, particularly over the memorable occasion of blocking, preventing Vince Gare from handing his resignation into the President of the Senate, so that, or in a time frame which would have enabled the Senate election in Queensland to have six senators elected instead of five. It's a complex issue, but if Vince Gare, who was appointed by Whitlam to be ambassador to Ireland for the purely political expedient purpose, so that the Whitlam government might win an extra Senate seat in Queensland and therefore break the deadlock of the Senate numbers in 74, Doug Anthony was absolutely the key behind thwarting that objective. by getting Bjelke Petersen to issue the writs for the election earlier than otherwise would have been expected. Gough never saw that coming. Gough Whitlam was a QC, so was Lionel Murphy. Doug Anthony was a pig farmer. So, but he was quite apart from that, I mean, his other key thing, of course, he was trade minister. He did an enormous amount of trade work of benefit to Australia. He was, you know, I mean, the live sheep export trade, controversial certainly, but an extremely valuable trade to the rural sector. He opened up a lot of trade opportunities to the Middle East. Doug Anthony loved the Middle East, absolutely loved it. And it wasn't only live sheep exports, but there were all sorts of other business and commercial links with the Middle East that Doug Anthony was responsible for. He went to Russia quite a few times. He opened up a lot of opportunities in Russia. One memorable occasion, he got sick on a trip to Russia, the press gallery speculated that the Russians had actually tried to poison his food and all this sort of business. It was all quite bizarre. Doug to this day doesn't know quite how or why. I think he actually picked up a dose of hepatitis and it knocked him around a hell of a lot. So on trade he did an enormous amount of work. In terms of the party, yes, he certainly thought to the future of the party in terms of the name change. He didn't need to think too much about succession from his point of view because it was always going to be Sinclair or Hunt. But on the other hand, there are some within the party who I think, with some justification, say that he didn't give opportunity to some of the younger members of the parliamentary party that McEwen had done, for instance, with Anthony. And there were younger people there with some potential, you know, likes of Stephen Lusher and Sandy McKenzie. These were guys who were backbench members who, as it turned out, lost their seats subsequently. But, I mean, had they been given a bit of opportunity, even in a parliamentary secretary-type role, you know, might have been able to blossom a bit more. Doug certainly he was held in high regard too. His leadership was never threatened once in all the time he was leader, from 71 until his retirement in 84. That's a long period of time not to have any internal rebellions. And when he was sick with hepatitis, I mean, he was out of action for 7 months or more. And again, you know, politicians, parliamentarians are impatient people by nature. It's quite staggering that nobody over that period of time ever turned around and said, "Well, gee, Doug's a bit too crook for the leadership. We better move on." You know, nobody did. So he was fortunate. He had great support from his comrades there, and was able to retire after a highly successful political life, I think.
What would you say about his personality? What was he like as a bloke?
Yeah, well, he was often a bit hard to read. I've only really got to know him in more recent years, I suppose. But he was interesting. I think it's probably best put by one of his former head of, who was actually the former head of the Department of Interior. This is going back a long time when Doug was the Interior Minister, his departmental head, recalling Anthony as the Minister for Interior, said to me, "We used to have this body called the National Capital Development Commission, and we'd have this meeting with the Minister, and Doug would sit there with his blue eyes, with a smile across his face. He always had this benign smile, happy look about him. And these people would prattle away about what they wanted and what they wanted, and Doug would say this and Doug would say that, and they'd all leave thinking they got absolutely what they wanted when in fact they got absolutely nothing." In a way, that sums him up. You can't quite read Doug. You don't quite know if he's listening to you, if he's bored with what you're saying, but he's always got this very pleasant smile on his face, lovely blue eyes, but by gee, stubborn. Absolutely stubborn. If Doug wanted to go in one direction and he'd set his mind to it, there was nothing going to change him, nothing. But he'd be very polite in putting you down. He was a very polite man. I've never heard Doug Anthony lose his temper. Just don't think that was in his nature. But loved to play practical jokes too. Play practical jokes. He was cheeky. He was a cheeky bloke. And they all were, I think. So was Nixon, so was Sinkers, and so was Ralph Hunt. They were all out of the same mould, because they all came from the bush, they all came from farm families. Well, Sinclair was less a farming family, but he'd gone on the land anyway. They had that sort of larrikin sort of country attitude about things. Mm-hmm. There's a famous story that Doug tells himself about when, again, shortly after he got elected to Parliament, there was him and there was Seb Barnes, who was a Queensland member, and Peter Nixon. This would have been in early 60s, 63 or something. They were kicking a football around in King's Hall. This is when the greed men, as we used to call them, the attendants, they used to go off, and there weren't that many of them, and they'd go off and around, you know. And these guys were kicking a football around, and it hit a picture of one of the presidents of the Senate that was hanging on one of those main central columns, and it had glass in it, of course, a glass shattered. Bang! You know, so these three guys scribble around like school kids, picking up the broken glass, picking it out of the side of the frame, chucking it away, making themselves scarce. Doug said it stayed like that without glass in it